Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year. We are picking up our study in chapter 14 of Revelation. JJ's not here, so I'll tell him later, but I want to express my appreciation for JJ and Gail for picking up for me while I was away. It's not always that easy to find people willing to fill in for you on Revelation, so it's I appreciate them being willing to step in. And on some of the chapters that there's a lot of interesting ideas about. So I appreciate that. We're going to pick up chapter 14. I'm not going to go back and try to reteach what they've done because they covered everything that that I would have. But just kind of to set the context, because this is kind of the pattern of Revelation, is it's grim, it's grim, it's going to be bad. And it's not so much, I don't think, to scare Christians, and not certainly the Christians of John's time, but more to just kind of, let's go into this with our eyes open. Let's be realistic. Denise and I were talking about this right before before class began. And, you know, I think I've said this a couple of times in this class, Revelation feels more practical this time around than it ever has before, because we see a movement in our country in authority toward an anti-religion, anti-God. There are a lot of, if we just want to be honest, a lot of ungodly things that are being pushed by people in authority, people in influence in this country. And if you really go back and look at what Rome was during the time this letter, there's a lot of similarities between things that are going on. Maybe we're not quite that far yet, but I don't think it's unfair to say we're headed in that direction. And as such, the church has to decide now what we're going to do about it, you know? And I think the book of Revelation is not so much an attempt to scare us, although there are some frightening things being talked about in this book. But it's more the idea of we need to prepare ourselves. We need to recognize what being a Christian can mean and what being a Christian can cost. And we need to, you know, as Jesus said in his, I guess it's a parable about building a tower, you don't start building a tower without counting the cost. And I think that's what the book of Revelation is encouraging to do. So in the last two chapters, chapters 12 and 13, we had all these really kind of frightening, you know, you had this dragon and all the power, and you had these two beasts and the bizarre, and I know y'all talked about the similarities between the beasts in chapter 13 and the beast of Daniel 7. And at the end of chapter 13, you know, the beast is putting his mark, or I think it's the land beast, is causing them to where if you just wanted to live, if you just wanted to go about your daily life under the rule of this beast, you had to accept his mark on you. And we talked about, when we were talking about the horsemen of the seals and the black horse and the famine, the scarcity, and we talked about some of the persecution that these Christians were facing, is in some cases they were being denied access to resources because they were marked as being Christians. And all that is recorded in the history of this 200 some odd year period of persecution that the book of Revelation, I think, is addressing. So you've got these kind of grim, I mean, the end of chapter 13 kind of ends with a, kind of a, you're just, wow, that doesn't sound good. Then here's chapter 14. So, and this has kind of been the pattern. Things are going to be bad, things are going to be, but look at this. And that's what chapter 14, and somewhat chapter 15, I think is, in the pause of that, in the, being realistic, recognizing that it's going to be difficult, here's encouragement, here's hope. And at one point in this Bible, or in this Bible, in this chapter, in verse 12, it says, here is the perseverance of the saints. And I think that's the purpose of the book, really. But in this scene, I think it's injected here because these are the things that cause the saints to be able to persevere. So that's kind of the context for us in this section of the book that we'll be studying today. So just a couple more quick things on the previous chapter. Gail said that y'all had a chance to talk about the significance of the number 666 and some of the ideas that are out there. I agree with Gail in that I think it is simply the number of mankind, in that man is short of God. He falls short of God. It's imperfect. It's repeated three times, just like the holy, holy, holy was repeated three times in the throne scene to emphasize that this is the most. So 666, failure or falling short, falling short, falling short. And that is identified as the number of the beast. So the mark of the beast, you know, all of these people that are receiving a mark of failure upon failure upon failure. So even in some of the grim scenes in Revelation, if you look at them closely, there's still that undercurrent that this is what they're trying to do, but it's ultimately unsuccessful. Who caused the mark to be put on these people? It says the beast from the sea. Well, who was giving him his power? Well, he was empowered by the beast from the, I'm sorry, I said that wrong. The beast from the land was causing the mark to be put on. Who was given his authority by the beast from the sea? Who was given his authority by the dragon? Okay, and the dragon is identified as Satan. But what did we see happen to the dragon in the previous chapter? There was war in heaven, and he was cast down. So again, you know, the power behind the throne, if you will, Christians of the first century who this book was written to, the power that looks so overwhelming, and then you understand that behind that, it's not just a king, it's not just an emperor, but it's actually Satan himself who's behind it. But the last time he tried to defeat God, he was cast out. You know, and that's a recurring theme through Revelation as well. So we come to this scene then. In verse 1, John says, "And I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him was the 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth, for they are blameless." So the 144,000, we've talked about them before. In this scene, there's a mountain, and it's identified as what? Mount Zion. So we got, let's go through the elements of the vision. We've got the Lamb. We know who the Lamb is by this point, right? Right. And remember now, in chapter 5, in the scene around the throne, this is the Lamb that when he took the scroll, there was a new song sung. And it said that he was worthy of all power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And then they go on to sing a similar song to both the Lamb and the one on the throne, indicating when we went through that passage that they were of equal stature. So it's not just an angel on this mountain, it's the Lamb on this mountain. It's Mount Zion. What is the significance of Mount Zion? What was Mount Zion?
Jerusalem.
Okay. What was in Jerusalem? Yeah. Well, God's people, yes, but I think the idea here is the temple. Often Mount Zion is described as the Temple Mount. You know, that is where, in a lot of Old Testament prophecies, the new kingdom was going to be established from Zion. The temple was on Zion. What was the temple again? The house of God. And another way to say that is it was the presence of God. So again, you've got the Lamb. You've got Mount Zion, which ultimately is a symbol or represents the presence of God. And who's right there with the Lamb and the presence of God? The 144,000. And if you recall from chapter 7, we went through that definition. You know, there's a lot of ideas available about, you know, the significance of that number. And I think it's very simply just God's faithful people. And in the immediate context, I think it's God's faithful people who are being persecuted and even giving up their lives during this time of distress. But I think you can apply that in a larger sense, although I think it's more in keeping that this 144,000 are those who during this 42-month period, and we've talked about the 42 months in chapter, is it 11 with the two witnesses? The chapters start to run together on me, honestly. And then, again, the beasts were empowered for the 42 months or the 1,260 days or the time and half the time, however you want to put it. That period of time we talked about a couple of weeks ago represents a time of suffering, but a temporary time of suffering. That victory is on the other side, or redemption is on the other side. I actually think it can be even more specifically applied to this period of persecution here in the immediate context. I think, you know, the beast is going to have this power to do war upon the saints for this 42 months. But that is an incomplete, imperfect time, a time of suffering, but a time that is not going to endure. Again, that's consistent with the theme of the book of Revelation. Things are bad. Things are going to look really bad for the church for a while. But on the other end of that is victory. So here we have these 144,000. They're on the mountain. How are they described here? Says that they have the Father's name written on their forehead. In direct contrast to what just a few verses before had we seen. We saw all these people that were having the name of the beast, the number of the beast, the mark of the beast, either on their forehead or on their hand. Well, now in direct contrast, because I think the chapter break is somewhat unfortunate here, but it's hard to break Revelation into chapter. This is a different vision. John has seen this vision of the beast, and it ended with the beast marking those who wanted to get along under the rule of the beast. And now the scene switches to the mountain, and here's another group of people, and they have a mark too. But now it's the mark of the Father. So, you know, these are the two sides, if you will, in this conflict. It's those who have accepted and are willing to go along with the beast, and then those who have accepted the mark of the Father. Again, going back to chapter 7, this 144,000, it says that they were sealed. And I don't think it's inconsistent to say that the seal was probably what's being referred to here as the name of their Father. But their allegiance, their choice, they bear that mark, that they have chosen to be gods. They're singing a new song. Again, echoes of chapter 5, because when the Lamb took the scroll from the one on the throne, it says that they sang a new song. Now, in that case, it was all these heavenly beings around the throne that were singing the song. Now we see the 144,000 taking part in that as well. And again, that's similar to what we saw in chapter 11. We saw the celebration of the multitude. It wasn't necessarily defined as the 144,000, but I think that's just a different symbol to represent the same group of people, God's faithful. And in that scene, we talked about they were waving the palm branches. We talked about the significance of that from the Feast of Tabernacles, that was a celebration of joy and victory, of God's bringing his people through something, of God seeing his people to the other side. Well, now we have a similar image. You have this voices like thunder, you know, and that says several things. It talks about, I think, the intensity of the joy. You know, when you're happy, you sing, but when you're joyful, you sing loudly. It's the power behind those voices, you know, that these are with the Father and with the Lamb. These are where they are because of Jesus the Lamb and God the Father on the throne, and their voices reflect that power. Maybe it's the number of them. But this song that John is hearing is just, it says it's like thunder. And yet it's beautiful because it's also described as like the music of harps. So it's a joyful, wonderful thing that he's seeing, and they're there with the Lamb. And if there's any doubt about their condition, who else is there, or at least suggested in verse 3, who else is involved in this scene? Yet again, the 24 elders and the four living creatures, which back at the beginning of the book, where did we see them? We saw them right around the throne. You know, if heaven has a center, then that's the center. It's God's throne. And these are beings that are at the center. Well, where are the 144,000? they're right in there with them. They're not off on the edges. You know, okay, yeah, we bring them up, put them over here while we, but they're included in the center of all things, because it says that they're singing there before the throne and before the living creatures and the elders. So at least to me, that suggests that in some apocalyptic way, this scene is almost imposed, is the way I kind of envision it, over the throne scene. That it's Mount Zion, and they're on top of the mountain, but the throne's there and the living creatures are there. And I think the suggestion, again, is that God's faithful people are going to be just as much a part of heaven as the four living creatures and the 24 elders that are immediately around. Now, physically, that doesn't work. You know, spatial geometry, you can't get that many people right in the center, but heaven's not physical. And I think the implication there is the value that God is attaching to these 144,000, which if you do take that as these are the people, these are the ones who are faithful through the persecution of the church by Rome, that would be an incredibly encouraging image to the people that this letter is addressed to, or this book is addressed to. These are the ones who have not been defiled. You know, so there's no question who these people are. They're the ones who have been faithful. In a word, verses 4 and 5, these are the faithful. They've not been defiled. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And I think another way to say that may be a little more, I hate to say accurate, because that sounds like I'm saying it wasn't said, but maybe another way to express that is they follow the Lamb wherever that leads them. Whatever is going to happen to them with these beasts and the judgments that we've talked about previously in the book, whatever it's going to cost them, these are the ones who follow the Lamb, I think is the idea. They are the faithful. Verse 5, no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Now, you can tell me if you think I'm reading into this a little bit, but to me, when I read that, what I immediately think of is the lie that's not found in their mouth is the lie that, well, you know, it's just a pinch of incense to Caesar. I'll tell that. I don't really mean it, because my heart is God's. But I'll do this to go along and get along and not have to suffer for it. But that lie is not found in these mouths. Maybe it's just they're honest. Maybe it's their truth. But to me, that just seems a little more fitting, that the lie that there is being said that they don't tell is the lie that they serve anybody other than the Lamb. They follow the Lamb. They don't follow Domitian. They don't follow the beast from the sea or the beast from the land or Rome or the emperor worshiper. Their God is the Lamb, and they're not going to lie and say anything other than that.
Whatever they're asked to do, they look and see, is God okay with this? And if he's not okay, I'm not doing it no matter what it costs me.
Right, right. And I think that goes along with the idea that they have not defiled themselves. If it's anything, whatever it is, however minor it seems, or however simple, or however you can rationalize it, if it's not what God wants me to do, I'm not going to do it. And you know, and again, Denise and I were talking about how to prepare for times that may be coming. And it's really very simple. It's not easy. Simple and easy are not the same thing. But it's that simple. Whatever I'm asked to do, is this what God would want me to do? And if it is, then I'll do it. And if it's not, then I won't do it. Again, very simple, not easy. And certainly what's being portrayed and what history tells us these Christians went through can't by any stretch of the imagination be defined as easy. But it is simple. And I've said that a couple times in our study so far. Revelation is all about making a choice. And the two sides of the choice are being described in vivid details, vivid imageries, over and over in all these different ways, but it all comes down to the same thing. You can be this, or you can be this. And God just wants you to be clear on what those two alternatives are. In this case, you can accept the mark of the beast, or you can accept the name of the Father. That's your choice. And that kind of fits in with the rest of the chapter. Any comments on the 144,000 on the mountain? From home or here? Okay, so everybody's got the 144,000 nailed down. Okay, good. Okay, so then the next vision, and I think chapter 14 is just a series of visions that John sees. I don't think they're necessarily linked together. together. It's just because he keeps saying, and I saw, or I looked. It's like a vision, a vision, a vision. I don't think we're trying to establish a course of events here. So in the next vision, he sees another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. Okay, here comes the gospel. Okay. He said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of the water." Okay, so he's an angel. He's flying. He's up above. You know, when you want to make your voice known to a lot of people, where do you usually try to get? You try to get above them so that your voice can carry. I mean, you never see big crowds of people being addressed by somebody standing down in the middle of the crowd. They're above so that they can be seen and heard. And this angel is flying in mid-heaven, and he's speaking with a loud voice. So this is meant to be heard. In other places in the book, there's been trumpets and thunderings and things like that. This doesn't have it, but I think it's still the same idea. It's attention. Pay attention to this. An eternal gospel. In what sense? And okay, let me take half a step back. Tell me what you think about this. I don't think this is the gospel that's referred to here.
But it certainly is good news.
It's good news, yes. But I don't think what's being preached, and forgive me for sounding cavalier, I don't think this is the hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized gospel. And I don't mean to make light of that, but I don't think that's what the eternal gospel is here. It's and Tom just made my point for me. Gospel means good news. So this is eternal good news. And what is it? Fear God and give him the glory. And what's the basis in this message? What's the basis for fearing God and giving him the glory?
He's God.
He's God, and as God, he is, well, he's the creator. And how many times does that come back up with God, especially in trying to make Israel understand the foolishness of idolatry? Is you're going to worship something you made with your own hands versus the creator of all things? Even back in the throne scene, when the living creatures and the elders are praising the one on the throne, it's mentioned that he's the creator, that he's the creator of all things. So here, this angel, the message to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe, it's not, oh, well, I don't choose to align myself with the Judeo-Christian framework. And I have actually had that said to me, talking to a friend of mine that described himself as a pagan. And we were talking about the Bible and stuff. He said, well, that's all good, but that doesn't apply to me because I don't align myself with the Judeo-Christian framework. It's like, well, God created more than the Judeo-Christian framework. And this message here that this angel is speaking is to, it doesn't have anything to do with Judaism or Christianity as far as being the boundaries of where this message applies. God created all things, and this truth, this good news, is for everyone, for every created thing, which is everyone. Fear God and give him the glory. Now, the somewhat ironic good news part of this, but in the context of Revelation, and Debbie said this a moment ago, is because he's not only the creator, but he will also judge the unrighteous. We've already seen in the book, specifically with the fifth seal, that the saints who are suffering are crying out for judgment and for justice. And I think the idea here is that will come. And we're going to see that play out in the rest of this chapter. But that's an eternal gospel in the sense that that has always been the case. Whether it's under the new covenant and Christianity, or the old Mosaical law and Judaism, or before that with Abraham and Noah and Methuselah and all the patriarchs, this has always been the truth. This has always been the good news. Fear God. He's the creator. Give him the glory. But he's also a just God. And he will. And the thing about judgment is it's a two-edged sword. Because judgment for these 144,000, judgment is not a thing to be feared. Judgment is the thing. That's when you get your reward for being faithful to God. That's judgment too. We tend to, and maybe it's a worldly influence, but judgment tends to carry a negative connotation. Well, oh, judge, he's a God of judgment. Oh, no. No. For us, him being a God of judgment is a good thing. For these 144,000, for these saints who are suffering under Rome, God being a God of judgment is a good thing, because that means that everything they've gone through will be vindicated, will be made worth it, will be just like when we talked about the two witnesses. And they were slain, and the world rejoiced and mocked, and yet they were brought back to life. And not only that, they ascended into heaven in front of everyone that had been rejoicing over it. They were vindicated. That's judgment. So our God is a God of judgment. And there is cause for concern there if we're not being faithful to him. But if we are, then that's a cause for encouragement. That's a cause for comfort. Because whatever is being done to us, God will bring all those things into judgment, and we will be vindicated, and we will eventually get to the mountaintop. I don't know if that's exactly where that phrase comes from, is this scene. You know, we talk about getting to the mountaintop. Maybe I've never made that connection before. Maybe that comes from this scene, but that's our goal. That's why we're here. That's why we live the way we live, is we want to get on that mountaintop with the Lamb and with the 144,000. A second angel, verse 8, comes and says, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." So again, what's the tense of this phrase?
It's past tense. It's done.
It's done. Now, has it happened yet when this book is written? No. To be clear, I skipped over. Babylon is Rome. And we've seen back in chapter 11, the city where the witnesses were slain, it says Sodom and Egypt. We see different cities used to represent Rome, but they're always cities that are known for what, or have a reputation for what? Wickedness, ungodliness. In Babylon's case, arrogance. I always think, anytime I see Babylon in Revelation, I think about Nebuchadnezzar and the arrogance of him and the lesson that he was taught. So I think simply, if you want to underline Babylon over in your margin, write Rome. I think that's the thought being expressed here. So this angel comes through saying, "Fallen, fallen," past tense, "is Babylon the Great, who has made the nations drink of the wine and the passion of immorality." Rome is pushing the ungodliness, and people are going along with it. They're receiving the mark so that they can get along with Rome. And, you know, Rome's got all the power. Rome holds all the cards. And Rome wants us to be this way. Rome wants us to accept this and act this way and say this is okay and laud this and despise that. And people have gone along with it. And people are going along with it. The message here to the saints is, don't go along with it. The first angel says, "Fear God and give him the glory, for judgment is coming." The second angel comes along and says, "Rome has fallen." Not will fall, as John said, has fallen. When this book was written, if we're right about our date, 95 AD, Rome hasn't fallen yet. But God has determined Rome is going to fall, so you can say Rome has fallen. Because it's just as sure as if you're at 500 AD looking back at Rome, or you're 95 AD looking forward at the fall of Rome. Either way, it's just as true, because God has decreed it. That's God's judgment. And Rome can do what it wants, and Rome can take whatever measures it wants. But Rome's number is a 6, not a 7. And it's not just one 6, it's 3 sixes, which means it's the most 6 it can be. You know, Rome will fail, I think, is the idea here, to where this angel is speaking in the past tense. Then, again, I think the idea of the threes. Here comes a third angel. And he says, "If anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand," everything's going to be great, because you're getting along with the greatest power in the world. Yeah, that's not the message at all, is it?
You're getting the same thing as them.
Yeah. He says, "He will drink of the wine of the wrath of God." And not just that, which is mixed in full strength. Now, up till now, we've talked about how, you know, this trumpet sounded and a third of the earth, or this horseman was given power to slay a quarter of man, or this earthquake and 10,000 people or 7,000 people, a tenth of the city fell, partial. But now the language is shifting. Now it's, okay, again, choice. You've got the mark of the beast, you've got the mark of the Father. This third angel is saying, if you have the mark of the beast, you're going to receive the wrath of God. You're going to drink the cup of the wrath of God. And not just partial anymore. Now it's full strength. So you see the progression. You have the angel who comes and says, hey, nothing's changed. Fear God, give him the glory, or judgment, because judgment will come. Second angel comes along and says, Rome has fallen. Rome is not going to win this. Third angel comes along and says, and if you choose to receive Rome's mark, if you choose to align yourself with Rome, this is what you can expect. The wrath of God. Torment with fire and brimstone in the presence of his holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. Smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. No rest day or night. Those who worship the beast in his image, whoever receives the mark or mark of his name. I mean, that choice is crystal clear, is it not? There's two marks. And you notice that there's only two choices being presented here. You don't get to be neutral. You don't get to be Switzerland in this. But for those who choose the mark, this is their outcome. And it's very, and later on in the book, we're going to see that same kind of language is applied to the beasts themselves. So in other words, kind of like as John said, those who receive the mark of the beast are going to suffer the same fate as the beast because they chose the beast over the Father. And then verse 12, I think really verse 12 to me kind of summarizes the entire book. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith. And then the language goes on. It's like, so verse 12 is not looking forward. Okay, here it is. Verse 12 is looking back on what's been said and said, here it is. And I think specifically it's on the mountain, the 144,000 on the mountain. And then it's the three angels and the progression of fear God or face judgment. Or maybe I should say fear God because judgment is coming. Babylon has fallen and those who have aligned themselves with Babylon are going to suffer torment and destruction with no rest day or night. I mean that, and then then John says, that is the perseverance of the saints. And I think it's significant, and again, maybe I'm reading too much into it, is we have this instance here where the angel says Babylon has fallen. And to me, that just speaks to the certainty of God's judgment. So again, when you're sitting there weighing Mark of the Beast, Mark of the Father, Mark of the Beast, these are not what might happen. These are not probabilities that you're weighing here. These are certainties. So your choice is Mark of the Beast, eternal torment, fire, brimstone, day and night, no rest, or Mark of the Father, singing on the mountain with the Lamb and the elders and the four living creatures. Again, very simple when it's cast that starkly, not easy. Being faithful to God is a struggle. And I think it's a struggle right up till the very end. But it's not like God hasn't given us enough motivation to get through that struggle. That's the point of the book. That's the perseverance of the saints.
Hey,
Carl, yes, sir.
Just a little bit of a version difference for 12. Verse 12, here is a call for the endurance of the saints.
Okay. I think that's what Revelation is. A revelation is a call to faithfulness. In the face of, in their case, some pretty horrible circumstances. But it's not, oh, well, you know, things are going to be really bad, so I understand. It's a call to faithfulness. Things are going to be really bad, but you be faithful unto death. Because if you overcome, this is the choice that you're making. Debbie, do you have a comment?
I have a question, actually. When the eternal gospel is proclaimed to all those who live on the earth, to men of every tribe and tongue and nation and people. And so this eternal gospel, that whatever good news it is, it's being told to all. Is that an indication of God's mercy and that he's still saying, look, there's still time to change to, you know, all men? Because inherent in this, there's time because there's given this call to fear him. And yet the destruction, the judgment, are these angels describing his judgment that is sure to come. And this is why, even though it's addressed to Christians, there's still the need for a call for repentance from the world to be brought in, to, for those who might change their mind in the midst of all of this.
Okay. Okay.
Is that possible?
I do think that's why. For those of you that might not have been able to hear Debbie, her question about the eternal gospel being preached to every nation and tribe is the sense that a warning of judgment to come. So could there be an element of a call for repentance and mercy, patience on God? Because it is, and really that is, I said this wasn't the gospel, and I don't think it's the gospel in the sense that we usually think of the gospel. But part of the gospel is a warning that judgment is coming. And you need to repent while there's time. So if this is a gospel in the sense of being preached to all men, all nations, in the sense of a warning of this judgment coming, certainly there's a warning against accepting the mark of the beast here, which I think in the direct context is meant to be encouragement for those Christians. But it certainly could appeal to those who haven't become Christians yet that, hey, if judgment's coming, and the church is being called to set itself against Rome, and the church is being assured that it's going to win a victory over Rome, maybe I should be a part of that church.
Perhaps it might be an encouragement to those Christians to not neglect the duty to continue to reach out to the world around.
Okay. And I certainly think that was the significance of the two witnesses that we said, that is the truth is still being proclaimed. You know, the gospel is still being preached. In the face of all this, during this 42 months, during this time of great suffering and persecution upon God's people, in that earlier vision, the truth, the two witnesses, are still preaching. And attempts are made to overcome the truth, suppress the truth, kill the truth, but those, while it may look like they are having some success, that success is temporary, and ultimately the truth wins out. So I do think that element. So I don't think it's inconsistent to say that that's part of the idea here. I think the main thrust of the chapter is making this choice stark. You know, this is what happens to those who choose the mark of the beast. And really, you know, up to chapter 5, this is what happens if you choose the mark of the Father. The rest of the chapter is addressing, I think, what happens to those who choose otherwise.
In Romans chapter 2, it talks about the goodness of God, supposed to lead the Jews to repentance. In verse 16, on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. And so there's a text here that brings this contrast. You choose. And my gospel includes there's a day of judgment.
Right.
So it would go well with that.
Right. And 2 Thessalonians 1 is very clear that there will come a day when mercy is done. And Jesus, when he comes back, will take vengeance. Is that how it says? On those who afflicted you, those who did not obey the gospel. So certainly, again, judgment is a two-edged sword. So, and God's nature is somewhat of a two-edged sword. He is a God of love. He is a God of mercy. He is a God of grace. He's also a God of righteousness. He's also a God of justice. And the thing that makes the difference in how you look at God is what choice we make. And that's what I'm going to keep saying this, because I think that's what Revelation is about. It's make your choice. And God allows us to make our choice. He just wants to make sure. And I think as starkly as anywhere else in the Bible, the consequences of those choices are made very, very clear in the book of Revelation. Moving on to the last vision in this chapter, there's a vision of a reaper, or a harvest, if you will. How many reapings are described in this vision? Yeah, it's two. It's two. The first is there is a being sitting on a white cloud, and he's described as one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his hand, on his head, and a sharp sickle in his hand. We've talked about clouds before. Clouds are often used in the sense of judgment, coming judgment. White is the color of purity or righteousness. This personage it says he's like a son of man. A lot of people, in fact, in my Bible, that's capitalized, his head, because that's often taken to represent Christ himself. Or it could be a heavenly being acting with Christ's authority. Either way, it doesn't change the thrust of the vision. An angel comes out of the temple. Out of the temple where who is? Where God is. So by coming out of the temple, it's the idea of this is God's will being expressed. This is God's plan, if you will. Comes out and he says to this being on the cloud, verse 15, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. And that's really all that's said about the first reaping. So we have to do a little bit of inferring here. Jesus said something similar to this to his apostles in Matthew 9, 37, 38. He said, pray that the workers will be sent forth, for the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. I think this is a similar idea. It's not really explicit on who was reaped. It just says that he swung his sickle and the earth was reaped. But the fact that he's dressed in white raiment, he's wearing a golden crown, he's on a white cloud. I said that wrong. I don't think it says what his raiment was. It says he was on a white cloud. But it's the idea of this is purity and righteousness. And if you want to say Jesus, I don't have a problem with saying this is actually a representation of Jesus. He reaps his, I think, is the idea here. At the will of the Father, because that was the whole point of Jesus coming, was to preach the gospel so that his among the world could be gathered in to himself. That's what being a Christian is all about, right? Is we want to be gathered in as part of the harvest that Christ is going to reap through his sacrifice among men. So I think that's the image here. So we have the reaping of the righteous. Yes, and I think that's exactly right. There's two harvests here. Now, again, don't read too much into this, as some people do. Oh, well, this is the rapture. First, the righteous are going to be gathered in from the earth, and then all these horrible things are going to happen. That's not, if there were other passages supporting that idea, you might could infer that from that. But this by itself, these are two separate things that are being considered. There's nothing in here necessarily to indicate that this happens and then a number of years, 1,000, passes and then this happens. This is just two harvests being described. So you have the being on the white cloud who swings his sickle and reaps the earth at the direction of the temple. The angel comes out of the temple. So I think, you know, the idea is this is God's will being executed. Then another angel, again, comes out of the temple, which is in heaven. He also had a sickle. And yet another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar and called out with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. Okay, again, this may be reading in a little bit, but when I read the angel who had the power of the fire who came from the altar, I think back to the seventh trumpet and the angel that took the coals out of the fire under the altar and cast them down in response to the saints' pleas for judgment upon the wicked. It doesn't have to be the same angel, but it's consistent. What is in picture here is now, you know, I think the first harvest was the righteous. Now we're going to talk about the harvest of the wicked. Because look at what, and it's interesting that there's more detail being given here to the second. The first harvest is, you know, he swung his sickle and the earth was harvested. Here we get a little more detail. But again, I think that's in keeping with the context of the chapter. The first part of the chapter, we've already talked about those who choose the Father, the mark of the Father. Now we're kind of dwelling on, or we're focusing on those who don't. So we get more detail in this second harvest. What's he harvesting?
The unrighteous.
Okay, but in the vision, what is he told to harvest?
Great.
He says, the clusters from the vine of the earth, because they're ripe. Okay. What's another word for the clusters on the vine? Sorry?
Grapes,
which are fruit, which are... What's being reaped here is the fruit of the earth. Another thing, when people talk about the fruit of this or the fruit of that, what do we tend to think of in Bible terms? Actions or deeds. I think, you know, and again, I may be stretching the metaphor a little bit here, but what's being reaped here are the deeds of the earth. In other words, the wickedness, the unrighteousness, the arrogance of Rome, the wickedness of the persecution, the rebellion against God, the defiance of the give God the glory, the eternal gospel that we saw. Now it's time for that to be reaped. And anytime I think of reaping, I go back to Galatians 6. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. What you shall reap, or what you shall sow, you shall reap. I think that is the idea here. It's the beasts are doing this. Rome is doing this. Those who have aligned themselves with Rome are doing all these things. And now we have a picture of the time. He says in verse 17, the grapes are ripe. The time has come. In the fifth seal, the response to the saints were they were comforted, they were given new robes, but they were told to wait until all the number had been tallied. Another way of thinking of that is until the time is ripe. Canaan, back in the patriarch, Canaan was allowed to go until, at least once, I know God said, until the iniquity of the Amorites has come to its full, or something to that effect. So now God's, again, it's the idea of in his time. So to Debbie's point, there's still time, but when the time comes, there will be a harvest. Verse 19, the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. So if there was any question about what's going on here, I think that kind of addresses it, that this fruit, these deeds are being taken, and what are they going to produce? They're going to produce wrath because they're being put in the winepress. And the winepress, in verse 20, says it was trodden. I've always wondered about that. You know, trodden sounds like trampled is what I think. But actually, the way the winepress worked, it just means it was operated, because that's the way the winepresses were worked. They got on them, and they trampled them, and they worked them, and they squeezed the vine. So it's not the idea of the winepress was trampled in that it was overcome, like we think of when we think of something getting trampled. It's just the winepress was operated. And the deeds produced what the deeds of the earth, what the fruit of the earth, what the fruit of the wicked produce. Wrath of God. And it says that blood came out of the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. I read a lot this week about depths and volumes and things like that, and lots of different ideas on what region this. It's just a sea of blood. I mean, it's going to be bad. What comes out of the winepress of God's wrath when the deeds of the unrighteous are put in there and it's operated, when the wrath comes, it's going to be bad. You know, I don't know if y'all have spent much time around horses, but a horse's bridle tends to be around about this tall. Think about blood that deep. Even if it's just in a bathtub, well, not a bathtub, maybe a pool, but think about blood that deep. And then, at least in the New American Standard, it says 200 miles. So I kind of picture like a, as far as you can see, blood this deep. Okay, so lots of people try to attach lots of significance to that. That's bad. And I think the message here is you don't want any part of that. So pick which name you want to have. Because you can be on the mountain, singing praises with the Lamb, or you can be drowning in a sea of blood, at least in this image. So, again, I think chapter 14, to me, is one of the kind of linchpins of the message of the book, because here in a fairly small section of the book, the contrast between faithfulness to God or otherwise is vividly portrayed. And the whole book is doing that, but I think here, if you want to just, you know, kind of take the Cliff Notes version of Revelation, you find it here in chapter 14. Any questions, comments?
Paul, when he said that some of the Praetorian Guard have become believers, and to think how this would affect those who are entrenched in the infrastructure of Rome, they could probably just blend in and maybe avoid persecution.
Yeah.
And how indicting it is that they have to make a decision. They have to make a difficult decision.
Yeah.
And that really describes us, because we are in the infrastructure of this wicked world in which we live. We're blend in just as those who may have been wearing a Roman soldier's uniform.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I keep going back to the conversation Denise and I had, but we were talking about, you know, for the last 200-ish years, we've lived in a country where we have said something like this would never happen. I'm not sure we can say that anymore. With some of the things that have gone on just in the last 20 years, I'm not sure that we can say that about where we move and live and have our being anymore. So I think Revelation is timely in the sense that you can't make this decision in the moment. You have to be ready for when these, because we're sixes. We're imperfect. We fall short. And if you haven't prepared yourself for what you're going to do, if you have to face these kind of choices, when the moment comes, the tendency, I'm not going to say always because, you know, there's exceptions, but the tendency is for us to take the course of least resistance. There's a reason why why we all recognize that phrase, because that tends to be what we do, unless we have compelling reasons not to. Chapter 14 is a compelling reason not to choose the course of least resistance, and I think that's the purpose of the book. But it is something that we need, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. That would be my daughter. And I'm not trying to scare anybody, but I do think we need to be aware of some of the movements that we're seeing around us and what that could very well mean, if not for us at our age, certainly our children may be facing the same kinds of pressures that are being described in this book. And the encouragement in this book may be much more, not relevant, that's not really the right word, because all of Scripture is relevant, but more immediately applicable than it has been for most of our adult lives.
Just remember, much of this language is back in the Old Testament. The old wine press and the judgment. So this is a reminder, folks, that so many of these imagery, you can find very similar passages in the Old Testament. So it's not like a new concept or something.
Right. And that's a very good point. Gail made the point that a lot of this imagery, like the wine press being trodden out and the wrath coming forth, you find in the Old Testament. And again, that's how we kind of steer clear of some of the more outlandish interpretations of these things, is going back and looking to see what it meant there. And we did that when we were talking about the sky being parted like a scroll, back with the sixth seal. And we went back and looked, and that same language was used of Babylon by Isaiah. And the heavens didn't part like a scroll. Literally, it was a term. So it's important to do that. And unfortunately, with just the time that we have in class, we don't really have time to really go back and look at all those in detail. But I think the idea of the fruit of unrighteousness being put in a wine press and the wine of unrighteousness, if you will, the produce of rotten fruit is not good. Is very clear, and we don't have to go back and explore the Old Testament to understand the principle behind that. Okay, we will pick up next week with chapter 15.